and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the White House trumpeting the biggest tax cut in history, which will add bigly to the deficit by allowing the top taxpayers to call themselves pass-through corporations, reducing their tax rate down from 39% to 15%, which is the new corporate tax rate Trump is proposing. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of a Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer, joins us to discuss how these so-called tax reform proposals are the same old tax cuts for the rich that are supposed to magically spur the economy and create jobs, as well as his latest article at Common Dreams, Donald Trump's Big Tax Cut for Himself. Then we'll examine the tweet storm from Donald Trump following a ruling by a federal judge in San Francisco that blocked his executive order targeting sanctuary cities. Kevin Johnson, a professor and the dean of public interest law at the University of California, Davis, joins us to discuss Trump's latest attack on the federal judiciary that include a personal attack on the judge who issued the nationwide preliminary injunction, as well as an attack on the Ninth Circuit, which did not make the ruling that Trump mischaracterizes as a gift to criminal gangs and cartels, when in fact the judge ruled Trump's order will likely violate the Constitution by depriving a jurisdiction of funds unrelated to immigration. Then finally, we'll get an update on the just-concluded meeting at the White House by U.S. senators invited there for an unusual briefing on North Korea by the Secretaries of State and Defense, the Director of National Intelligence, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to discuss whether this was a photo op for Trump or an opportunity to learn what strategies are to be employed following a sixth North Korean nuclear test, which is expected soon. And joining us now is Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest book is Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Donald Trump's Big Tax Cut for Himself. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And Dean, today the Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, didn't give any details, but he vowed that the Trump administration would have the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. But without any details, it looks once again, this is more about tax cutting than tax reforming.
Well, as best we could tell, I mean, the part that's been most widely advertised is this cut of the corporate tax rate to 15%. It's currently 35%. And I think you get a lot of agreement that it makes sense to lower the rate, because the reality is we don't get 35%. We get around 22%. So the business people run around yelling 35% so high and everything. But the reality is our taxes, what corporations pay, is probably a little less than the average of other wealthy countries because there's so many loopholes. So the logic is let's get rid of the loopholes and actually get something like, let's say, 25% and have a 25% rate. What Trump is saying, no, we're actually going to have a 15% rate, which would mean we'd get considerably less than what we're now getting. And what he's proposed to throw into the works is this tax break that would allow people like him, really rich people like him, to make out like bandits. Because what he's proposed is to allow pass-through corporations, and this might sound a little complicated, it really isn't. A lot of people organize their businesses pass-through corporations, which means that the business, in effect, pays no tax. They just pass on the money to themselves as individuals. If you're a high-income person like Donald Trump, you're in the 39.6% tax bracket. What Trump's saying is, we're going to let pass-through businesses pay a 15% tax rate also, and that would be it. So going from today at 39.6% tax rate on wealthy individuals, you'd instead just pay 15%. That is a massive, massive tax cut for the very richest people in the country.
Well, of course, they are promising also tax cuts for individuals, which we'll get to in a moment. But I recall Paul Ryan once saying that cutting the corporate taxes to 15% was not revenue neutral, that it would blow a hole in the deficit. That still stands, right?
It does in the real world. You know, I'll be the first to say I'm not one of these deficit hawks. I'm not hugely worried about that, although we'd probably be seeing larger deficits than even I would like to see. But the reality is the idea that what the Republicans are now saying, that we're going to have enough growth to make up for these cuts, that really is ludicrous. I mean, it's the best stories you could tell is you'd have a very, very modest increment to growth. And I should point out, the way they're proposing this will almost certainly be a subtraction from growth, because you're going to create a huge tax shelter industry. Anyone in their right mind, any wealthy person, I should say, in their right mind, they're going to figure out how to have their income as pass-through income. So, say I'm a successful doctor earning $700,000-$800,000 a year. Well, currently I'm paying tax 39.6%. Why don't I just become a pass-through company and I'll pay a 15% tax rate? So you're going to have a huge amount of resources devoted not to anything productive in the economy, but to figuring out how people could shield their taxes. That's 180 degrees wrong way of where we'd want to go.
So that really will blow a hole in the deficit, won't it? I mean, that would be one of the biggest areas of revenue collection for the IRS, wouldn't it?
That's right. I mean, you know, look, the wealthy people are where the money is, and increasingly that's where more of the money is. So when you give them an opportunity to avoid taxes, and this is totally legal, so we're not even talking about someone breaking the law. This would be totally legal. I'm going to be, instead of being Dean Baker doctor, I'm going to be Dean Baker Corporation. Totally legal. And I'll just have to pay a 15% tax rate. Why on earth wouldn't people do that?
So we've heard this refrain before, haven't we? I mean, it seems almost like Groundhog Day. You cut the taxes on the rich and magically all boats will rise. I mean, give us a break.
Not that I would like it if they just said, hey, we want to give more money to rich people, but at least it would be honest. And you just go, come on, we've tried this. I mean, first off, there's a lot of economic research, and, you know, from across the political spectrum. I always refer to people to a study that was done by Douglas Holtz-Eakin when he was the head of Congressional Budget Office. He's a Republican. He was head of George W. Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. And he looked at this. He's going, you know, what's the evidence? And he found there's very, very little evidence that you could get enough growth to replace any more than a small fraction of the revenue loss. So that's the research. And again, I refer people to do that, because Holtz-Eakin was not trying to stack the deck against the Republicans. Absolutely the opposite. I mean, I think he's an honest guy, but I'm just saying, if he had a prejudice, it was to go the other way. It was to say they do pay for themselves. But then we actually did the experiment. You know, it's not often you get to experiment with the whole country's economy. But we did that in 1981 with Reagan. We did it again with George W. Bush. And in both cases, the deficit exploded. So again, I'm not one to scream about deficits, but if we're trying to say the tax cuts are going to pay for themselves, that's absurd. They don't. It's not even close.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. His latest book is Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article at Common Dreams, Donald Trump's Big Tax Cut for Himself. So back to Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan pretty much showed his cards over the repeal and replace of Obamacare, where he really did want to go after Medicaid. And he's not made that. He's actually said in an interview with Hugh Hewitt, said that he was proud of the fact that they were really going to cut Medicaid for the first time. And now he's promising a middle-class tax cut by taking away the payroll tax, or by getting rid of the payroll tax, which many are arguing is a Trojan horse. In other words, you throw a bone to the middle class and say, we're going to give you a tax break by getting rid of the very tax that funds Social Security and in part Medicaid. So it seems that Paul Ryan really is a zealot. He wants to get rid of what little we have of the social safety net. Am I being fair here?
Well, he's pretty much said this, so you're not putting words in his mouth. I mean, I remember debating him back in 2005. He was an open supporter of President Bush's privatization plan for Social Security, and he's put out any number of proposals for privatizing Medicare. So that's hardly a secret. I mean, he said this, and he seems to be intent on doing it through a back door now, with saying, oh, we're going to give you a big tax cut by cutting back the payroll tax, and won't that be great? And don't worry, we'll fund Social Security and Medicare from other sources. And just as a common sense matter, I go, look, we've been funding Social Security from a designated payroll tax for 80 years. Doesn't have to be. I mean, we could fund it from a tax on bread. I mean, you know, but this is the way we've done it. And to say, okay, we're going to get rid of that, and we'll trust the Republicans, who have wanted to get rid of Social Security from day one. We're going to trust them to maintain the revenue stream from other sources. You would have to be nuts. But clearly he's hoping we have a lot of crazy people out there.
Well, but do we have enough Democrats to stand up for this? I mean, even Trump himself said we're not going to go after Social Security, and he was smart enough to know that that was a bridge too far. Are you confident in our political opposition that they're going to rally the American people and let them know that this is a con, this is a Trojan horse, you're going to lose your Social Security?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Democrats... Look, the American people overwhelmingly support these programs, and it's across the board. I mean, it's not just Democrats. I mean, there's very little difference. If you look at polling attitudes on Social Security and Medicare, it's almost the same Democrats and Republicans. You're talking about approval rates of 75-80%, and as a practical matter, Republicans count on more because they're older, so they're the ones who are most directly going to be hit by any cuts in the program. So I find it very hard to believe that, just from their own self-interest, I mean, I'm sure many Democrats do believe in the programs as well, but they're politicians, and this is an incredibly popular issue for them to say, look, we're defending Social Security and Medicare. Those guys want to cut the programs or want to privatize the programs.
So what's happening there in terms of who's advising Trump? I mean, Mnuchin was his campaign finance chair. And he has a pretty sleazy record, frankly, of kicking people out of their homes and getting rich as a result of that. But there's also this other character, Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs, and there's quite a few Goldman Sachs people in there. My understanding is that since Trump was blackballed by Wall Street, in a way, he likes having these Goldman Sachs people around because he's sort of finally been accepted back into the club. What's your understanding of who's behind this? Because Cohn used to be pretty liberal, and then he got really conservative as a result of Dodd-Frank, which they clearly want to also go after. So who's Trump listening to, or is he just listening to Jared, or is he listening to himself?
Well, tax cuts are easy for the Republicans. This is kind of like believing in God for a conservative Christian. I mean, that's what the party's about. So tax cuts for wealthy people, really, that's their most basic dogma. So I assume Trump buys into that as well. But in any case, that's pretty much across the board. Now, when it comes to attacking Social Security and Medicare, again, Republicans have long wanted to do that. Trump made a point of distinguishing himself from the other candidates in the primaries of saying, no, he wants to protect them. We don't have to cut them. So in that case, this is a really big flip-flop, which in some ways I think probably makes it even harder for him to do it, because he was running around the country telling voters, hey, you should vote for me because those guys want to cut your Social Security and Medicare, and I'm saying you don't have to do it. So I don't know who he's listening to on that. That is, again, the Republican dogma, but it's 180 degrees at odds with the positions he espoused during the campaign.
Well, I guess that my question gets to the idea, is there a sober, responsible steward of the American economy there? Is anybody looking long-term? Is anybody thinking, you know, we're not just going to raid the Treasury, make our friends rich, and then let the chips fall as they may?
I think this is about raiding the Treasury and let the chips fall where they may. I mean, part of the story, the Republicans in Congress were proposing a cut in the corporate tax rate to 20%, which is a very substantial cut. But that would lose revenue, but not an inordinate amount of revenue. Making it 15% is really huge. Now, maybe that's a bargaining chip and it'll back away from that, but that's a huge reduction. And then on top of that, to make this loophole for S corporations, people like Donald Trump, I calculated he could save $65 million a year on this, to allow them to just pay the pass-through 15% rate and get out of paying a much higher tax rate on their income, their individual income, that's just a total scam. So no one thinking long-term strategy would propose something like that.
But meanwhile, just to focus on the reality of what's really happening, the Republicans, not only are they against Social Security, against Medicaid, and in favor of endless and repeated tax cuts for the wealthy, they also keep taking money away from the IRS. And now the IRS apparently is going to have private debt collectors. So the IRS is the only part of the government that actually makes money. The rest of the government spends money. And if you take away their ability to collect money, you can't have it both ways. You can't say the sky is falling over deficits while you make it impossible for the IRS to collect funds and revenues. So
yeah.
Where's the, you know, again, I wish there were, our opposition in this country were making it clear that this is just such flagrant dishonesty.
Yeah, this is again, just kind of an amazing story, because it's estimated by the IRS commissioner that they get $4 in taxes for every dollar they spend on collection. So the idea is that you have a lot of people who aren't paying their taxes, and this is the law. So we could argue over the tax rates, and I can understand that. I mean, I differ with where they want them to be. But once you set the rates, the idea that you want people not to be able to pay the taxes if they don't feel like it, I pay my taxes. I want to know that everyone else is paying them too. If it's optional, well, I guess I'd rather not pay my taxes then. I mean, that makes it into a joke. So cutting the IRS budget is just a total joke. And again, the issue of going to private debt collectors, we had that. We moved away from that because there were any number of abuses. That cost us money. Again, it made the debt collectors rich, so there are businesses that do that, and they make a lot of money on it. It cost the government money. And on top of that, of course, there are any number of incidents where you had private collectors who were really abusive of people. We want them to collect the debts. We don't want them making death threats. And that's the sort of thing that you had and we'll no doubt see again.
So this is really just privatization, right?
Yeah, and it's privatization in a really shoddy way, because there are areas where you could debate whether the privatization makes sense. This has been tried. We have the evidence. It doesn't save money. It just leads to abuses.
So do you think then, just back to Gary Cohn, who's apparently getting more FaceTime, that's what we hear. I mean, I don't know that there's much point in focusing on who's up and who's down and all that process stuff that the press is pretty much obsessed with about the White House. But there's this impression that Trump is learning that if you're going to run a government, I think he's finally come to the conclusion that he is the president and he actually has to try and do the job, which I don't think he expected to get and probably had no interest in. But now it does seem like he's figuring out, well, I better run the damn government. And surely he's finding people around him like Cohn and others who are more competent than the ideologues like Bannon who just scream and rant. Do you think that's what's going on?
Well, he has at least people who are somewhat competent, again, Cohn being one of them. But, you know, again, Cohn's not someone who has any experience in government. So his top people, without exception, on the domestic side certainly, have zero experience with government. Certainly Cohn, Mnuchin, his Treasury Secretary. So I'll give them credit. I mean, I assume they're reasonably intelligent individuals, but he really has no one there that has the sort of years of experience you'd like to see for someone in top position. I'm just saying someone I'm not going to like his agenda, but I think I would like that the people who are trying to push it at least have some idea what they're doing.
Well, I bring it up because it seems like with the decks so much stacked in favor of Goldman Sachs, and, you know, after all, it's a perennial joke that we call it Government Sachs, the revolving door between Goldman Sachs and the government. That's nothing new, but this is a really kind of a critical mass of Goldman Sachs people in the White House, and Gary Cohn seems to want to really undo Dodd-Frank. What do you think Wall Street wants? Because there's a lot of ticking bombs out there like there was before the crash. The subprime auto loans is a accident waiting to happen. What do you think what does Cohen and Goldman Sachs want?
Well, they want the freedom to make as much money as possible. Look what happened coming out of the last crash. I mean, just to be clear, I don't see anything like that again, but they weren't hurt by it. I mean, you had a few individuals who were badly placed, and obviously Lehman went out of business, but the individuals themselves, almost all of them, walked away with huge amounts of money. I'm forgetting the guy's name, who headed Lehman. He walked away with over $100 million. Same with the guy from Bear Stearns. These people messed up absolutely as much as possible for a person. It's possible for a person to mess up. They're still immensely rich. No one goes to jail. So they wouldn't mind running through that again. I'm not saying they want to see the economy collapse or see, you know, massive downturn and bad loans and everything, but none of that was a bad story for them.
So can we expect then Dodd-Frank is going to get killed or unraveled?
Watered down, at least. I don't know if they'll literally kill it in the sense, logistically, it's hard to directly repeal it, but they can make it so that it has very little teeth.
Well, just in closing then, where do you think the debate about income inequality that Bernie Sanders brought to the table, where does it stand in your mind? Because this is what everything we're talking about in this interview is about how the rich are going to get richer, how the system is rigged against the middle class, how the swamp is not going to be drained, and how you're all going to get hosed. So
that's Donald Trump's agenda. Don't assume he's going to get that through. The Republicans are terrified. They had two seats that were open that, you know, were blowout districts for them. That in one case, Kansas, their candidate won by seven points. Previous candidate won 37. The one in Georgia is very much up for grabs. Again, a seat that had been safely Republican for decades. They're scared to death. So this Donald Trump's agenda, the idea that he'll get away with it, no, I don't take that for granted at all. There's a lot of opposition, and the Democrats are responding to that. You know, Bernie Sanders just introduced the bill, $15 an hour minimum wage by 2024, has a lot of very centrist Democrats as co-signers. So I think things are moving. I mean, it's going to be a very big battle here. There's no doubt Trump wants to give more money to rich people, and Paul Ryan wants to help him, but that's not a done deal.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest book is Rigged: How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy are Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he has an article, Common Dreams, Donald Trump's Big Tax Cut for Himself. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the tweet storm from Donald Trump following a ruling by a federal judge in San Francisco that blocked his executive order targeting sanctuary cities.
You need it, that's for sure.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kevin Johnson, who's a professor and dean of public interest law and a professor of Chicano and Chicana studies at the University of California, Davis. He served on the board of directors of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund and is the author of How Did I Get to Be a Mexican? A White Brown Man's Search for Identity and Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Johnson.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Dean Johnson. And it's pretty extraordinary how the president has erupted in a tweet storm following the ruling by a federal judge in San Francisco that blocked his executive order targeting sanctuary cities. But this is particularly egregious, it would seem. I mean, we've seen these attacks on the judiciary from day one. But in this case, again, he attacked the judge personally. He attacked the Ninth Circuit that had nothing to do with the ruling, and he mischaracterized the ruling as a gift to criminal gangs and cartels when, as far as I can see, the judge is ruling that Trump's order will likely violate the Constitution by depriving a jurisdiction of funds unrelated to immigration. So walk us through those points, if you will.
Well, there's a lot there, and I think it's fair to say that President Trump doesn't like losing in court, and he's been known to criticize judges and courts pretty regularly when he doesn't prevail as he would like to. He did that in the Ninth Circuit after Washington versus Trump was decided unanimously by three judges on the Ninth Circuit, and he's doing it now in a case involving this. Is called the Sanctuary Cities Provision, one of his executive orders. I think that Judge Orrick issued a pretty careful and detailed opinion. It's about 49 pages in length, finding that one section of the executive order, the section that relates to sanctuary cities, was unlikely to withstand a constitutional scrutiny. And the truth of the matter is that U.S. Department of Justice did not try to defend the constitutionality of that executive order. Instead, what the Department of Justice did was to claim that the city and county of San Francisco and Santa Clara County did not have standing under Article 3 of the Constitution to raise these claims. And it was pretty clear and pretty well-reasoned, Judge Orrick's decision that San Francisco and Santa Clara had standing. And so when he got to the constitutional law questions, there was basically no defense from the Trump administration, and it was a pretty easy pickings, as a lawyer would say.
But isn't there a broader context here in the sense that from day one, both Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, and Donald Trump have created a very dystopian portrait of America that doesn't gel with reality? In his inaugural address, he talked about carnage in America. Sessions says we have this out of control crime. The statistics don't bear that out. Even in this criticism of the judge, it's the idea that it's a gift to cartels and we have to build a wall to keep these hordes out. And the inner cities are full of chaos and they're unlivable. What's going on there in that? Why are they making such a dystopian and bleak and inaccurate picture of America?
Well, it's hard for me to say. I do know that from the campaign, from the very beginning, Donald Trump made immigration a central issue, claimed that criminals from Mexico were destroying this country, and promised to deport as many criminals as he could in his years in office. He also championed from the very beginning an extension of the U.S.-Mexico wall, even though it's not clear to me that that's going to deter immigration in the least. And it's certainly not going to deal with the people who enter the country legally and then overstay the terms of their visas. I do think that President Trump understands that there are some Americans who do support a very strong and stringent immigration policies, and he plays on that, and some would say he contributes to a firestorm of concern by painting these bleak pictures of what America is because of immigrants. The truth of the matter is that social science study after social science study reveals that immigrants are less prone to crime than United States citizens, are less prone to consume public benefits as U.S. citizens, and are in many ways contributing mightily to the strength of this economy. So it's even though some of what President Trump says and Attorney General Sessions says does tap into some anti-immigrant sentiments among the base, I don't think it's very closely tied to the reality of the matter. And it certainly threatens immigrant communities across the country that really are terrified by what's happened the last few months and are not certain what's going to happen in the future. Unfortunately, throughout American history, we've seen episodes like this where political leaders tried to capitalize on immigration as an issue, and sometimes they've done so successfully. And some would say that President Trump and Attorney General Sessions are trying to do precisely that in this instance.
Well, as we know, as the Attorney General Jeff Sessions just recently referred to a federal judge in Hawaii as being this, how come some judge on an island in the Pacific can stop the President of the United States from conducting his responsibilities to protect and defend the nation? Well, of course, Jeff Sessions conveniently forgot the fact that he praised a single federal judge in Texas who had blocked Obama's immigration policies. So what's your sense of why both the Attorney General, who should know better, and the President keep mischaracterizing and not understanding the role of the judiciary in this country?
I think that they're political leaders who are making political statements to get political gain. I don't think that they are fairly or accurately portraying the justice system as it works in the United States. And federal judges do have the power to issue nationwide injunctions. And I don't think that a federal judge ordinarily would do so without great attention and careful reasoning. And it seems to me that it's very unfair the kinds of criticisms that have been leveled at the federal judges who are involved in some of these executive order cases. But the thing is that Donald Trump started his criticism of federal judges, at least in the public sphere, when he criticized the judge, the distinguished judge, Gonzalo Curiel, who was presiding over the Trump University case, and he suggested that because of Judge Curiel's Mexican ancestry, he might not be impartial in deciding the dispute. the truth of the matter is that Judge Curiel was born in Indiana. He was born to Mexican immigrant parents, but he was a U.S. citizen by birth, and he had served in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And there was no hint of partiality in any of his orders in that case. And it was very unfair, I think, to criticize a judge for basically doing his job. In this instance, Judge Orrick, in striking down, or at least initially at this stage of the proceedings, finding that the sanctuary provisions of the executive order were unconstitutional, he was just doing his job and enforcing the separation of powers that's embedded in our Constitution.
But Donald Trump's own sister is a federal judge. Surely he must know something about the federal judiciary.
Well, I would hope so. It's either he's not certain about how judges rule and decide things, and he's making misstatements, or he knows how courts rule and decide things, and he's making misstatements. It's hard for me to know which one, but it does seem the attacks on the federal judiciary go to the core of judicial independence, and it seems to me that he's trying to bully on the federal courts so that they don't rule against him in the future. Doesn't seem to me likely to have much of an effect, but that seems to be the strategy.
Well, in his tweet, Donald Trump said, first the Ninth Circuit rules against the ban, and now it hits again on sanctuary cities, both ridiculous rulings. See you in the Supreme Court. Now, he, of course, has appointed Justice Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. He may get another bite at the apple. What's your sense, then, of that kind of, I mean, clearly in that tweet, he mischaracterizes the Ninth Circuit being involved in this when it has nothing to do with this, I mentioned earlier. But what about this timeline and this kind of threat, if you will, or this swagger? See you in the Supreme Court, you know?
Well, I mean, I do think that there are rights to appeal decisions, and you could appeal this decision if you wanted to the Ninth Circuit and ultimately the Supreme Court. I think when it came to the first travel ban, the Trump administration, the Department of Justice decided, well, you know, we're not going to win wherever we go, so they redrafted, you know, the order. I think that the problems in this instance are so serious that the Trump administration may decide to redraft the order to make it more narrowly drawn and coherent, because currently it's very overbroad and not very certain. I do understand your point. Is the tweet basically a threat, saying I'm going to appeal, and we'll get yours from the U.S. Supreme Court? And I don't know what to make of that, except to say that yes, the U.S. government can appeal, and maybe they will, but perhaps they'll exercise better judgment and try to fix the order as opposed to get the Supreme Court to buy something that probably isn't fit for prime time.
Well, the White House is basically beating up on San Francisco, too, you know, saying it's a sanctuary city, and San Francisco and cities like it, I'm quoting from the White House, are putting the well-being of criminal aliens before the safety of our citizens, and those city officials who authorize these policies have the blood of dead Americans on their hands. I mean, you know, this is... Obviously, there was a young woman who was out with her father on the Embarcadero and was shot by... immigrant who had an enormously long criminal record. There's no question that we do have problems, but the subtext seems to be liberal San Francisco, this kind of dog whistle.
No, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a fair characterization. And I think that San Francisco and other cities in some states are going to resist the Trump administration's immigration policies, and they're going to be attacked politically for that resistance. I do think that cities like San Francisco, counties like Santa Clara, states like California, and other states and localities, New York, Washington, Hawaii, for example, are going to resist and aren't going to be bowed by this threat. I do think it's very unfair to suggest that these cities that have immigration policies and don't have higher crime rates than cities that don't. There's no evidence here, no facts that would suggest that any of these cities that are, or states that are challenging President Trump's immigration enforcement executive orders are crime-ridden or have problems other than those that, that other states and localities have. And to suggest otherwise really isn't consistent with the facts. I don't see the order issued by Judge Orrick as a victory for the cartels. I do think that the city and county of San Francisco and Santa Clara County do feel vindicated at this point by the judge's rulings. But I don't see the ruling have any impact whatsoever on migration patterns or on crime patterns or anything like that. It's hyperbole to say otherwise.
Well, do you think, though, that the declaration by the head of the Senate, Kevin De Leon, that he's moving forward to make the state of California a sanctuary state, do you think there is a kind of states' rights battle looming here, or are we talking about the California Republic, the Bear Flag Republic?
No, I don't see an independence movement really growing out of this, but I do think, and we've seen it for a number of years, when it comes to immigration law and enforcement and immigrant residents in our communities, there's been some tension and some back and forth between the federal government and the state government about their appropriate roles. We saw that when the Obama administration went after the state of Arizona when it passed SB 1070, an immigration enforcement measure that the Department of Justice thought infringed on federal powers to regulate immigration. Now we have a situation where sort of the shoe's on the other foot, so to say, where you have the federal government wanting some states to participate more in immigration enforcement and do more in terms of immigration enforcement, and those states are pushing back. I do think that we're likely to see for a good few years some back and forth between the federal government and the state governments about the appropriate role in immigration regulation and immigration enforcement. I don't know if that's altogether an unhealthy thing, but it can be a tense thing and one of conflict at times. And right now, it appears with this president and at least the makeup of the legislature in California, we have a very highly publicized disagreement about how the immigration law should be enforced and what role the state should play in their enforcement. So I think we're likely to see some back and forth for a good while, certainly as long as President Trump remains president. And I think it's something that's going to be worked out.
Well, when you say as long as he remains president, I think a lot of people are, there are sort of rumors of impeachment out there, of course, as we know. There are these inquiries into Russia. But in general, it just seems like more than anything, this regime is incompetent. And my sense is that you just said earlier about how these earlier executive orders have had to be revised and that this latest one may well have to be revised. What does that say about the people who are writing these orders in the first place?
I have to say this, and this is just my judgment. I think that some of the things that George W. Bush did in his administration I didn't necessarily agree with when it comes, for example, to things like special registration of Arabs and Muslim non-citizens. But I do think that the regulations and orders that were drafted by the Bush administration were not always, but generally carefully done and tried to comply with the law. And while I didn't respect the end result, I might admire at some level just the craftsmanship of those regulations. Looking at the first travel ban, looking at the sanctuary provision of the Interior Enforcement Order, I don't get the sense that lawyers were deeply involved in the drafting of these matters, or people that were deeply knowledgeable about government were involved. And I think that it's unfortunate that such matters of great importance to very vulnerable communities are being handled in a way that, in my view, isn't as carefully done or sensitive as it should be to the rights of the people at stake. So I think it may be harsh to say that they're incompetent, but it certainly is clear to me that the time and effort isn't being put into carefully crafting policies, orders, and related materials that fairly weigh all the different interests at stake. It seems to me at some level that what's going on is, we'll issue an order and satisfy a campaign promise. It really doesn't matter what the order says, but we'll issue it and see what happens. And we'll include so many different things. We'll see what we throw against the wall and what sticks. That, in my mind, isn't the best way of formulating policy or fairly treating people or coming up with a rational and coherent approach to very difficult issues that require care and attention. So I have to say it's disappointing to me to see this kind of haphazard drafting of orders affect people's lives and could affect them in dramatic ways. At the same time, it seems to me kind of embarrassing for the Department of Justice attorney, as he did, to say to the district court, well, even though the president's saying these things, he's just saying these things and using his bully pulpit to try to get everybody on board on this immigration enforcement agenda. He doesn't really mean everything he's saying. And I think that's unfortunate that we have leaders who are saying things that aren't being defended in court, that can't be defended in court, but are having a tangible impact in creating fear in our communities.
Well, Kevin Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I'll be speaking with Kevin Johnson. He's a professor and dean of public interest law and a professor of Chicano and Chicana studies at the University of California, Davis. He served on the board of directors of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund and is the author of How Did I Get to Be Mexican? A White Brown Man's Search for Identity and Immigration Law and the U.S.-Mexico Border. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update on the just-concluded meeting at the White House by U.S. senators invited there for an unusual briefing on North Korea. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, who is a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And an unusual briefing took place. It's ended just a short while ago. In the White House or in the executive office building for the United States Senate. Normally they meet in a secured skiff, they call it, in the Capitol, but they made a temporary skiff out of the executive office auditorium, the Eisenhower Room. And as far as I can tell from the tweets that are coming out from various senators, not much happened. I mean, there was no news, at least nothing new. Is there anything that you're getting, for example, from the Korean press?
Not necessarily. You know, briefing senators on key issues of national security, like North Korea, is, of course, routine. At the same time, summoning all 100 senators to the White House for this briefing is unusual, probably unprecedented. So there was the expectation that something drastic or even radical may be announced, but it doesn't look that way. So there's an element of political theater in this, and if I were to put a positive spin on it, I think this signals to various nations, principally North Korea and China, the resolve on the part of the Trump administration to address the North Korea threat, to make it a high priority, if not the highest priority, foreign policy agenda, unlike all previous administrations that have treated the growing North Korea threat as a priority, but only to be dealt with later. So it does send a firm message. There's an added gloss to this briefing, but on substance, I very much doubt anything new was released or divulged.
Well, a GOP senator did say that the briefing lacked even straight answers on what the policy is regarding North Korea and its testings of nukes and ICBMs. And there's an expected sixth nuclear test coming up in the next few days, is there not?
I would think so. I think the time is ripe for a major provocation like a nuclear test or even a long-range missile test. North Korea took a mini step back. There was the widespread expectation that North Korea may do this, carry out a nuclear test on the occasion of the founder's 105th anniversary of his birth, which is April 15th, the biggest national holiday. North Korea did not do that. And then there was the expectation North Korea may carry out a nuclear test on April 25th. This year marks the 85th anniversary of Army Founding Day. Now, the fact that North Korea did not go through with these major provocations does not denote good behavior. It's not a retreat, not even a tactical retreat. I think the next provocation will come, and sooner than later. Why? Because North Korea is very adept at smokescreen strategic deception. They like to do these things when their adversaries put their guard down. And moreover, there is a presidential election coming up in South Korea in less than 2 weeks, and the front runner is a big proponent of engagement, dialogue, cultural economic cooperation, which means generous aid to North Korea. And one might think that on the eve of such an election, North Korea might behave and not provoke the South. It doesn't work that way. The basic internal dynamics in the Korean Peninsula favors appeasement. The South Korean public does not support continued escalation of tension with North Korea. South Korea has simply too much on the line. South Korea is rich. North Korea is not. So the tolerance level, threshold for pain and escalation and casualties is quite different. And when North Korea provokes the South, there is an urgent need on the part of the government to listen to the public's demand for a return to dialogue, diffuse tension, re-engage North Korea. All the more reason that North Korea is likely to carry out a major provocation in the coming days.
Well, Senator Chris Coons, after coming out of the briefing today at the White House for the U.S. senators on North Korea, told reporters that preemptive strike options were not presented. Now, first of all, I'd be surprised if they divulged too much of a preemptive strike. It wouldn't be preemptive if they did. But what do you make of all of these sort of rumors of, that the U.S. somehow has some sort of Buck Rogers sci-fi way of screwing up missile tests, and that maybe there's a decapitation scenario? It was mentioned that that was a part of the briefing that General McMaster gave Trump. I mentioned that to the former U.S. ambassador to South Korea, Donald Gregg, recently in an interview, and he got pretty bothered by that idea that they would even be thinking along those lines of regime decapitation. So let's start with that. Have you heard rumors of that?
Yes, I have, and it's been reported in the South Korean press for nearly 2 years now. Now, it's one thing to have a plan B or C, to have a contingency plan, quite another thing to be ready to implement it. During the Clinton administration, Ash Carter, as you remember, President Obama's Secretary of Defense, as a junior official assistant secretary, spent almost half a year studying this case. What are the costs risks, potential benefits of a surgical airstrike on North Korea's plutonium reactor in a town called Yongbyon. And the results were, the conclusion was that the risks are simply too high, unacceptable. A strike against North Korea would most likely lead to retaliation, war, and you would have casualties in the south, tens of thousands in the opening weeks, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in the first 3 months, including many, many Americans. So it's one thing to think about these and have a contingency plan in wartime, but it would take a lot for the United States to actually muster up the resolve to carry out such a strike. I don't think we're anywhere close to it. Now, talking about it, you could argue, is the right thing to do, to send a message to North Korea. But I think repetition, repeated message falls on deaf ears and raises the risk of miscalculation as well.
So one of the things that I've often mentioned lately, and not exactly original, but as we know, there's no peace treaty. There's an armistice going back to 1953, that you have this sort of kabuki theater that goes on every day at Panmunjom, the little truce settlement there. Nothing really, it's almost like it's frozen in time. What do you think would happen if the United States suddenly decided we're no longer going to be the enemy? That to some extent, that was Gorbachev's strategy to end the Cold War, that we just refuse to be your enemy anymore. The idea that maybe the U.S. could just slap a peace treaty down on the table at Panmunjom and say, okay, you know, we're tired of this, you know, we're just going to cut you loose, we're just not going to be your enemy anymore. I know it may sound incredibly impractical, but my theory being that if the U.S. were to remove the enemy status, which is the glue that holds the North Korean regime together, the regime may come apart. So what do you think of that theory?
Well, I think it's impracticable. That is, there are just too many barriers. Congress, for example, would not stand by it, would not allow it. Why? Because mainly of the nature of the regime. We know that the regime has shown little regard for human life. A landmark 2014 UN report on human rights in North Korea makes the serious allegation that the regime is guilty of various crimes against humanity, including a policy of deliberate mass starvation. So diplomatic relations, a peace treaty even, is probably not feasible at this point. North Korea has been suing consistently for a peace treaty with the U.S. Going back to the early 1970s. And one reason, and this is no secret, one reason North Korea insists on a peace treaty is that such a treaty between North Korea and the United States would call into question the very raison d'etre of U.S. troops in South Korea. People will say, people from North Korea, obviously, but also South Korea and America, will ask, why are the troops there? There's a peace treaty. And that would lead to a certain demand for the withdrawal, redeployment of U.S. troops, the downgrading of the military alliance between the U.S. and South Korea, perhaps between the U.S. and Japan as well. And I think, historically, peace treaties or non-aggression pacts between adversarial opponents have at times been shown to be a historical ruse or a canard. They don't work. There was a famous non-aggression pact between Germany and the Soviet Union in 1938, which did not prevent war between them a year later. So I think North Korea wants protracted peace treaty negotiations during which North Korea will make various demands for concessions, censorship, no criticism of the regime, and so on. So there's a radical element to all this from the North Korean perspective. But I think the U.S. does not really want to go there at this point.
Well, I don't think it's practical, but I was trying to think of a way that you could throw the ball back in their court. In other words, put them in a situation where their whole raison d'etre would unravel.
Well, if the U.S., I know this is a silly thing to say, but withdrew from South Korea and effectively abandoned South Korea to fend for itself, then I think North Korea's threat to the United States would be diminished considerably, because we know that North Korea's major adversary is the U.S., But it's really South Korea when you consider the internal dynamic in the Korean Peninsula. For the Kim regime, the fear of one day being absorbed by the richer, freer South, that's an existential threat that they can't really overcome unless North Korea is able to use this military card, nuclear blackmail, nuclear power status, with which to prevail over the South eventually. And the key step in all this is to get the U.S. out of there and to downgrade the alliance. But, you know, history over the past six decades does not favor that kind of abandonment, which is what the U.S. did, pulling out of South Korea after having governed South Korea for 3 years when the U.S. withdrew troops in 1949. The U.S. left South Korea quite vulnerable, but then events took over when North Korea invaded in June 1950, and since then the U.S. has been committed to defending South Korea, and South Korea has grown to be a prosperous democracy. So it's impracticable for the United States to abandon the South at this point because of the special nature of the alliance.
Well, going back then to the South Korean elections coming up soon, the left party has a tradition of appeasement, which has got them nowhere. They give a whole bunch of money to the North and they get nothing in return. What explains that in terms of Korean public opinion? You know, it's just, it's pretty strange to have most of the Korean South Koreans against military policies and against escalation. All the stuff that's happening now, I can understand nobody in Seoul wants to be vaporized by an artillery attack that could happen at any moment. But at the end of the day, that's about as impractical as my suggestion, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of strong ethnic pan-Korean nationalism that, you know, the view that North Koreans are brothers and sisters, and they are, of course, historically, and that they don't really mean harm to us. They're paranoid. That's why they're saber-rattling. So there's an element of denial, and perhaps even as a defense mechanism, you know, this denial factor may be understandable, because if you live as a society in constant fear of being invaded or being bombed by North Korea, you can't really function. So there's sort of a complacent attitude when it comes to North Korea, but more pertinent is what I've just mentioned, the fact that South Korea has grown rich, too complacent, and does not in any way support escalating tension with North Korea. So the status quo, as long as de facto peace, as unstable and imperfect as it may be, as long as we have no war and de facto peace, then everyone's happy. And no one will support, very few people will support raising tension with North Korea. So there's a strong tendency for appeasement. And appeasement is fine as long as it does not lead to a greater trouble or threat. But I think over the past 20 years, we've seen that appeasing North Korea on the nuclear issue is really self-defeating.
Well, Sung-Yoon Lee, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.